In January 1964, a team of tiny red and white Mini Coopers stunned the world by winning the legendary Monte Carlo Rally. It was a stellar year for British cars that culminated in Goldfinger breaking box office records and making James Bond's Aston Martin DB5 the world's most famous sports car. By the 60s, on road, track and silver screens, the Brits were the ones to beat, winning championships and capturing hearts. Stirling Moss, Jim Clark, Paddy Hotkirk were household names and drove the sexiest and most innovative cars. Designers like John Cooper and Colin Chapman, dismissed as mere garagisti by Enzo Ferrari, the old man himself, blew the doors off Formula One and grabbed all the prizes, whilst Alex Isagonis won a knighthood for his revolutionary Mini. The E-type Jaguar was the world's sexiest car and Land Rover was the most durable. But before the Second World War, only one British car had triumphed in a Grand Prix. Britain's car builders were fiercely risk-averse. So what changed? What changed is discussed in High Performance, When Britain Ruled the Roads. It's by Peter Grimsdale, and it's my pleasure to welcome on the show right now Peter himself. Peter, good morning to you.
Good morning.
What a time it was to be alive in the early 60s. You had wonderful films like Goldfinger, and you had an incredible array of cars out there. Just the goose flesh has risen on me just describing half of that. But as we were discussing earlier off air, I mean, before the Second World War, Grand Prix was pretty much a German stroke Italian. You had auto unions, you had Mercedes, you had Alfa Romeo, Maserati, etc. And all the Britain had was the ERA. What happened?
Well, I think it's a combination of things. I mean, we didn't have any public road racing like the Europeans did. And we also, I think our engineers were very risk averse. And large motor manufacturers in Britain didn't want to get involved in motor racing. They saw it as dangerous and they were likely to do badly. So there was a kind of completely different culture from what you had in Germany and Italy, particularly, where the governments of the time were very keen to promote motorsport there as an expression of their national prowess. So it was that combination of factors, I think, that kept us out of the top league.
Of course, the Second World War and the development of aeronautical technology, in particular the Spitfire, and Britain's reliance on engineering changed all of that. And it's fair to say, I mean, the old man Enzo Ferrari's dismissive call of garagisti came back to bite him, didn't it, really?
It did, rather, because really the whole revolution, and it was a revolution in British motorsport, was led by really Colin Chapman and John Cooper. I mean, two guys, well, John Cooper operated out of his dad's garage and Colin Chapman out of the stable block behind his dad's pub in North London. And they were real outliers, both of them. And they came with none of the kind of conventions, none of the pressures on them that had exerted on their previous generations. Colin Chapman was very much influenced by aerodynamics. You know, he studied engineering, although he dropped out of university. And Chapman, he was just a kind of an innovator. You know, his first car was built out of two crashed Fiat Topolinos, and the basis of that car changed the whole design of motor racing cars after the war.
Of course, blazing the trail for all this was one of the most famous names, and if you were a sports car nut in the 50s, you can't escape Jaguar, the C-type. Absolutely. The beautiful D-type, and of course the sexiest car in the world, which came out in 63. Was it 61 or 63? I'm trying to remember. The E-type.
Yeah. Well, I think there too, it was a kind of accident. It was kind of an accident because William Lyons, founder of Jaguar, wanted to build an engine for a luxury car for the post-war period. And he wanted to have twin cams because he thought twin cams looked good when you opened the bonnet. And the car just, the engine just happened to be a potential race winner. And when he showed the XK120 at the 1948 Motor Show, first Earl's Court Motor Show after the war, he put it up as a show car. They were only going to build a couple of hundred of them. But by the end of the show, he'd sold all the 200. They ended up making 13,000 of those cars. And he was very wary of going into motor racing because, like his forebears, thought, you know, it'll just be so bad if we crash or don't do well. It just won't look good. But he was persuaded, actually partly by the performance of the very young Stirling Moss, when he took what was essentially a standard road car, XK120, to the Dundrod circuit in Northern Ireland, and won the race in the wet the day before his 20th or 21st birthday. And at that point, I think Lyons thought, you know, actually, we should have a go and have a go at Le Mans. And the rest is history, shall we say.
Indeed. I mean, Jaguar were always fated as sports car. You know, the famous victories in the 50s with the beautiful D-type. And as were Aston Martin, of course, when they were their races in 59 when they broke the Ferraris.
Yes.
But, you know, there was suddenly a plethora of great designs coming out of the UK, coming out of Britain, and we had and it wasn't all glamorous sports cars. I mean, you had cars that defined the 60s, such as the Mini, which is very much, I mean, whilst the Germans had been doing stuff with the Volkswagen Beetle, for a considerable period of time, the Mini was another one that really sort of broke the mold.
It was, and again, it was a kind of an accident, because after the Suez crisis in 56, petrol rationing briefly came back in, and so also came bubble cars from Germany.
The Messerschmitts and all that.
The boss of BMC at the time, Leonard Lord, was horrified by the sight of these things, and he told Isigonis to just go all out to build a small car to blast these bloody German cars off, bubble cars off the road, his words, not mine. And what Isigonis thought he had come up with was an economy car. But the perfectionist engineer in Isigonis also caused the Mini to be extremely effective. It caused its road holding to be extremely effective. And when John Cooper got his hands on one of these, he said to Isigonis, "You haven't built a people's car, you've built a racing car." And all they had to do was put an extra carburetor on, find some disc brakes that handily, tiny disc brakes that somebody was developing for aeroplane undercarriages, and put this combination on, and they had this race-winning, rally-winning car on their hands. Extraordinary.
I mean, 1964, the Monte Carlo Rally, it's a legendary rally anyway. It had all been preserved of sort of large cars. Paddy Hopkirk in the Mini Cooper, I mean, it was a jaw-dropping achievement, a groundbreaking achievement. And, of course, also, I mean, Stirling's sister, Pat Moss, was a Mini Cooper driver as well, wasn't she?
She was. She never really liked the Mini. She liked the big Austin Healey's, and she won won an international rally at the wheel of an Austin Healey 3000, a big, hairy, tricky car to drive.
Yes, indeed. But I mean, what was the reaction then when people sort of, because you could, I mean, Minis, they weren't too expensive. You could get your hands on a Mini and go running or go racing or just cruise up and down the King's Road, because there was a new spirit. There was a new sense of, you know, Britain could do pretty much anything. And it was modern, it was fashionable. And these cars really did show up the forefront of British design and engineering technology.
Yeah, it's extraordinary. I mean, the Mini was so different that initially it was quite slow to take off. But Princess Margaret had just married Lord Snowden, and they were kind of sort of counterculturally, but very much the it couple. And they had Minis. They went around London in Minis, and everyone thought, oh my God, this is so cool. And the Mini kind of had that lovely thing, that kind of slightly kind of cheeky counterculture quality that so much of 60s iconography had. A V sign to the establishment, a V sign to convention. You know, we're going to do it this way, we're going to do it our way. And the Mini kind of embodied that in a way, because it had been designed as one thing, because it was so functional and unadorned, that kind of had a design value all of its own. You know, rather like good Scandinavian furniture design. It was all part of that design ethic of the 60s.
And talking about about sort of Scandinavian furniture design, I mean, we spend an awful lot of time hammering and cutting away and working out what goes where. These cars were pretty much built, sketched out on bits of brown paper. I mean, none of this computer-aided wind tunnel nonsense and literally on garage floors across the country.
Yes, absolutely, and indeed on tablecloths. John Cooper tells a lovely story about having dinner with Isigonis, And Isigen has just got his pen out and started drawing all over the tablecloth of the restaurant. And when he came to the bill, he said, put a bit on for the tablecloth because we're taking it with us. And he actually hung the tablecloth up in the drawing office because they'd done some really useful designs that evening on it.
You talk about sort of the description of the great Alex Cecil, no mean car nut himself, has talked about the flamboyant mavericks and crazies. I mean, who populated the British motor industry. Talking about John Cooper, who wasn't a crazy, but was certainly a maverick. Colin yes. Chapman, the jury's still out on that one, surely.
Well, I mean, he was, in many ways, he was a genius and an incredible innovator. But he was a serial rule breaker. He was the man who just read between the lines of the rules. And it kind of caught up with him towards the end of his life.
Mm. And I mean, we're talking about, the fact that the cars were fated worldwide. I mean, this development of the cars, especially in the 60s, went hand in hand with motor racing programs, perhaps more so than it does now, because they were testing out things that were then to be used in the road car on the track. And at the same time, the look at the performance of the Minis winning the Monte Carlo, Lotus winning Grand Prix with the great Jim Clark, of course, Cooper winning with, of course, Brabham in the early days as well, and Bruce McCarron also racing with Cooper. I mean, there was a great sort of British feeling behind that, and the fact that there were also, a golden generation of British drivers, Graham Hill, John Surtees, and, of course, Jim Clark.
Yes, yes. I mean, I think the thing is that the post-war era let a different kind of person into motor racing. And before the war, it had been very much the preserve of the playboys. You really had to have quite a lot of money if you wanted to go motor racing and be prepared to lose a lot of money in the process. After the war, partly because the 500cc formula that came in after the war for people to race with motorcycle engines, essentially 500cc engines, and also the availability of a lot of spare airfields that had been concrete, with concrete perimeter roads, now no longer needed for once the war was over, ideal places to have to stage motor racing, as indeed that's how Silverstone developed and many other racetracks in Britain, which we just didn't have before the war. So you've got this combination of available tracks, a new kind of egalitarian atmosphere, opportunities such as through the Formula 500 series of races. So people who would never have got into motor racing before could find their way in.
And what was the reaction like from Maranello and from the Germans? I mean, obviously the German car industry had its own problems at the time, but all those great Italian marquees built, the Prances horses, the Alfa Romeos, the Maseratis, the French cars that were backed heavily by their own governments. What was their reaction to these garagistas coming up and tweaking their noses?
Well, it was extraordinary. Immediately after the war, the Italians started winning races again, almost as though they'd just been kind of, they just kept developing their cars through the war, and they were just completely unbeatable. So even the first big international races, like the British Grand Prix and other big races that took place at Silverstone in 49, 50, 51, often it was 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 first cars were Italians. So we were just nowhere. BRM made a valiant attempt to produce a really, really high-tech V16 engine, very much on the lines of what Mercedes had done before the war, but it was just too complicated. It just did not work. And really where the breakthrough came begins with Vanwall.
Yeah.
I mean, nobody remembers Vanwall now, but they were a classic British operation of putting together an engine basically built out of four Norton motorcycle engines. Chapman's people designed the chassis. John Cooper's people designed the chassis. Colin Chapman had a go at part of it. It was a kind of a lash-up, but it worked. And it won Britain its first Constructors' Championship. Mm. But what really changed things was John Cooper's cars. Putting the engine behind the driver just made the cars go around corners that bit quicker. And because Chapman and Kufel were building cars without conventional chassis. The body was the chassis, in effect, with those cars. They were just lighter. And so it meant that they were lighter. They weren't necessarily the fastest on the straights, but they were the quickest around the corners. Their tires lasted longer. They used less fuel. And they just got there and just ultimately kind of left the red cars behind.
There's a wonderful picture. I think it's maybe at Monza, and you see, I think it's Phil Hill and Von Trips. It might have been 1960, and they're in these front-engine Ferrari monsters. Hmm. And there's Cooper's little things, and the chassis, you know, the engine is part of the chassis. They look like they could be blown over with a feather. But it really, I mean, that really was that sort of... But by the following year, of course, Ferrari had embraced the technology and come out with the shark nose.
Yeah, he did. I mean, he said, you know, he'd famously said to John Cooper when he first saw it, he said, the ox does not push the cart. 2 years later, he had to follow suit.
You see, this is the thing. I mean, Enzo Ferrari, the old man himself, the master of the one, you know, the master of the one liner, if you like, Gary Giesta, and the whole thing. Why, and famously, when asked why he never took Derek Bell back, and he said famously, "I never reheat cold soup." I mean, the mystique that surrounded him, you know, in his ivory tower, you know, in Italy, with his perma sunglasses, like some padrino. And then you've got the British, you know, the British designers in the back of, you know, like I said, at the back of a pub, you know, hammering out on a tablecloth. Yeah. And the very British and the nationalistic thing, and I mean this in a good way, because Van Wall, we go back to that, British racing green was the colour. Yep. Two British drivers, of course, Stirling and Tony Brooks, were racing for Van Wall. And Stirling, of course, you know, wanted to race British cars and raced for Rob Walker, one of the great privateers, in his Lotuses and got his greatest victory with them. Stirling always wanted to race a British car, and that was perhaps the most important thing for them.
Stirling Moss was such a superb driver, but he had Fangio in the way. Fangio was he was one of those. It's a bit like in tennis with Federer. You know, it's just like there's lots of fantastic people. There are other people who could easily be champion. It's just there's one guy who's just that bit better and more consistent. And there's luck obviously comes into it, but it's a terrible shame that Stirling never got the championship that he deserved. He came second, I think. Five times.
Well, surrendering his car as well, wasn't it? That was the big thing, the ultimate act of gentleman. And also, you know, he had the Ferrari lined up, even painted for him before the crash at Goodwood at Easter.
Yeah.
Just
so sad.
When you're going through, but at least, I mean, he's still with us. So, I mean,
but he survived.
Exactly.
Unlike.
Anyway,
so many of them that era.
I mean, that was the thing as well with one of the things that you could lay the door at some of the designers. They were so, especially in the racing car thing, they were so fast and so pushing the boundaries of design, but perhaps at the price of safety.
Yes, I mean, I think the thing is that the sport back then was so dangerous, and it's very hard because there were no safety rules back then, nothing like what there are today. So. It's almost too easy to point the finger and say that car wasn't very strong, you know, because there were no regulations. You know, they were trying to make their cars faster and lighter and quicker around the corners. Inevitably, they became more delicate.
Where do you think it all? Because we're talking about this great period of innovation about people producing cars, and there are so many different car makes from the, like I said, from garage. Do you think it all began to go wrong then when it became too big and too unwieldy, and we got into the Leyland fiasco?
I think actually that is a common, it's a sort of perfect storm of factors. But you know, one of the things that people don't talk about enough is not getting into the common market in the 1960s gave the British car industry a real problem, because European car manufacturers had rebuilt themselves after the war through intra-European export. Renault, Mercedes-Benz, Fiat, they got back on their feet by selling cars within the rest of Europe. And it was a great place to sell cars because you didn't have to transport them very far. The temperatures were around about the same. The conditions, the road conditions, had much more similarities. Britain had been exporting its cars to America. I mean, initially, an amazing success and a whole other story, which I cover in my book. But that market had kind of was kind of over by the 60s. And we were still dependent on exporting to the Commonwealth. Countries far, far away, different road conditions, extremes of temperature. British cars did not do well in those environments. So I think not getting into the common market was where the trouble really started.
So when you came to writing this book, I mean there are so many characters and so many great cars. It must be just sort of relatively difficult not to go off on all sorts of tangents of sort of, you know, we mentioned the BRM, there was the HWN as well. We could have gone down all sorts of paths.
Yes.
So how do you pull this fantastic period of British creativity, you know, sports cars, Formula One cars,
yep,
the swinging 60s, you know, minis up and down the King's Road, Peter Sellers owning one, you know, everybody else owning one as well. I mean, how do you put that into a constructive narrative?
Well, it's interesting, and I look forward to hearing from readers as to whether it's worked or not. But I think the key thing is it's about people. You know, I think at heart, my book is about people. It's you know, the core, my heroes, really, the four heroes are William Lyons of Jaguar, John Cooper, Colin Chapman of Lotus, and Alec Issigonis, and several other people around them. But this is really a book about people. And what I also wanted to do, which is something that doesn't often happen in books about motoring history, car history, is actually talk about road cars and racing and rally almost in the same breath.
Mm.
Because I think there's more, although the synergies in many ways, you know, they went their own ways, that there are interesting synergies. And I think it helps me look at this kind of a different engineering culture, a different design ethic. Because what's so interesting, it's a bit like rock and roll, this period.
Yeah.
You know, a bunch of guys doing things completely differently from what had gone before. And Chapman and Cooper are particularly like that. And Lyons was always kind of in his own world. And he was a man who did two extraordinary things. He ran a successful company that always made money, but he also designed almost all his cars, the body shapes, himself. Right from the first SS1 in the 1930s through to the first XJ6 in the late 60s, he designed those cars. He couldn't draw, but he had a very good way of expressing what he wanted to the craftsmen around him, and created those beautiful shapes. The D type, the C type, the D type, and the E type were all created by Malcolm Sayer, who was an aerodynamicist they brought in to make their Le Mans cars go faster. But all the rest of them were done. That's an extraordinary thing, and something I feel, you know, we don't pay enough tribute to. I mean, I feel like William Lyons should be up there with, you know, Terence Conran and Mary Quant as somebody who changed the style of Britain.
If you had to have a 30-minute drive or an hour drive on an open road, which car and which designer would you take with, or which engineer would you take with you?
Oh God, that's a wonderful question. That somebody like me would—I'd take a day to answer that. But if I give you a quick answer, I mean, I would love to, you know, have had a lap of Le Mans in a C or D type Jaguar.
Oh yes, oh yes.
Chatting to William Lyons at the same time, I think would be amazing.
Absolutely. The book is called High Performance: When Britain Ruled the World. Britain Ruled the Roads. It's by Peter Grimsdale. It's out on the 16th of May. It's out tomorrow. No, it's not tomorrow. It's out on Thursday.
Okay.
Thank you. With Simon and Schuster. Peter, if people want to find out more about you or buy the book, is there a website? Do you do the social media thing?
I'm on. You can find me on Instagram and on Twitter. Anybody's welcome to make contact with me through that.
Wonderful. The book's called High Performance. It's by Peter Grimsdale. Peter, thank you so much for your time today.
Thank you.